Now we have Phyllis Bennis on the phone. And again, she's the director of the New Internationalism Project through the Institute for Policy Studies. She's a journalist, activist, political commentator, and has worked with the United Nations on a number of issues related to Palestine and the Middle East and advising UN officials on democratization issues. She's the author of 8 books and co-editor of 2, as well as numerous articles. So good evening, Phyllis.
Good to be with you.
Thank you so much. And so we've been talking with Tom Hayden on the first half hour and started out talking some about the Vietnam War and lessons learned and not learned and a little bit about the symposium that happened and then made it to other issues. But from your perspective and the work that you're doing, if you could comment on some of the lessons that you feel were learned and unlearned or yet to be learned.
You know, I think it's one of the extraordinary things about the Vietnam War that the anti-war movement in the United States was so extraordinarily broad and so defining that where you stood on Vietnam in many ways was determinative of where you stood on women's equality, on the environment, on the government writ large, on the rights of young people. All of those things were shaped, in a cauldron called Vietnam. So it was a hugely important movement. I think it's important to recognize that the anti-war movement did not end the war in Vietnam. The Vietnamese won the war. That's an important distinction that we rarely hear about in the mainstream media these days. But clearly the role of the anti-war movement in discrediting the war, in making clear that the war was illegitimate, immoral, and illegal, that was a very, very important part of it, just sort of how we look at it. And at the end of the day, there was a whole generation of people who came to understand their lives in the context of what were their responsibilities and obligations as citizens, as activists, as people who had something to say about the world and some obligation to act on that. That was really important. That hadn't happened before, and it's been a struggle to have it happen since. But if we're looking at specific questions, I think that one of the lessons of Vietnam that unfortunately the government learned very well was that there's a need to demonize enemies to legitimate a war. So in the context of Vietnam, the kind of racism against Vietnamese, the anti-Asian racism, the slurs about gooks, and was horrifying and taken as a matter of course. It's one of the things that led to the much wider opposition to the war in the African-American community, for instance, than among white people, something that wasn't one of the lessons we didn't learn as well in the anti-war movement. The movement was defined by the groups that called themselves anti-war groups, identified in the media as white and overwhelmingly male leaders who were not our chosen leaders necessarily. They were chosen by who got indicted or who was in the press. But what was true was that anti-war sentiment and the impact of the anti-war movement was far stronger in the African-American community. And it's one of the things that led to the famous statements like from Muhammad Ali, who said, "No Vietnamese ever called me nigger." That was a powerful capturing of that understanding. And unfortunately, what we see now is that racism, anti-Arab racism in particular, and Islamophobia are the 21st century versions of the kind of anti-Asian racism that was so prevalent during Vietnam. But the lesson they learned is if you want people in the United States to be willing to go to war and willing to hate some other people, you've got to demonize them. You've got to figure out how to make them different, how to talk about them not as people but as subhumans. And that's what they've tried to do. And I think it was a lesson that they learned very powerfully in Vietnam.
And how do you see the movements that arose to work against the Vietnam War, to end it, to bring peace, to bring justice? Mm-hmm. How do you find those movements happening today, as especially with the Middle East, which is such a difficult area to work with as far as peace?
Yeah. It's much more difficult now, ironically enough, and I think for a few reasons. One, the nature of U.S. involvement, the fact that there was a draft, a legal draft, not only the draft of poverty, the draft of lack of opportunity, the draft that still exists. You know, the notion that the military today is an all-volunteer force is really a specious argument. There is no legal draft, true, but people are drafted by the inability to find a job, the lack of money to go to school, the lack of other alternatives. Are there some people who choose to go into the military? Of course there are. There always were, with or without a draft. But that's not the majority. The majority go in because it's a way to get health care, to make a living, maybe to see the world. It's a way to get a life that you don't have the option for in other places. When there's a legal draft that affects potentially every young man and the young women who are involved with them, their sisters, their lovers, their wives, etc., you have a generation of people who feel personally connected to the war in ways that is not true anymore. The isolation of the military from the majority of the American people is a huge crisis that has never been taken seriously, that allows, among other things, allows the sending of U.S. troops, U.S. bombers, etc., without most people in this country being affected by it. So that's one of the things that makes it more difficult now. Another thing is the nature of the so-called enemy. You know, during the Vietnam War, it was in the context of the Cold War. It was in the context of national liberation movements throughout what we now call the Global South, what we used to call the Third World, meaning Asia, Africa, Latin America, the Arab world. And in that context, while the majority demand of the peace movement was to bring home the troops, get the troops out now, there was a core of activists within the movement who supported the other side, who supported the right of the Vietnamese to get rid of the French, get rid of the Americans, and rebuild and reunify their own country. That's not a reality anymore. That was also true during the Central America movements that grew out of the Vietnam-era movements, where people not only said, get, you know, U.S. aid to the Contras ended, get the U.S. support for the dictatorship in El Salvador ended, but also said we support the FMLN in El Salvador. We support the Sandinistas in Nicaragua. In the anti-apartheid movement, again, for the majority of people, the demand was to end apartheid. But many, many people, particularly in the African-American community, went beyond that to say we support the ANC. Now, that doesn't mean now, and it didn't mean then, that we necessarily supported everything they did. There were, you know, atrocities are committed by all sides in all wars, and there was no justifying some of those acts. But there was support for the social program that they stood for. That was a very different reality than today, where the enemies, those who are fighting against U.S. troops in Iraq or U.S. troops in Afghanistan, are not any kind of organizations or movements that we want to support. So it's one thing to recognize that, yes, people living under military occupation in Iraq or Afghanistan or anywhere else have the right to use force against their occupying forces, but that doesn't mean we necessarily support what they stand for. That makes it much harder. It makes it more complicated. So there's a number of reasons why it's been so much more challenging. And then the final reason, I think we have to look at the effect of 9/11. In fact, it was probably not 9/11, but 9/12 that changed the world. 9/11 was a huge crime against humanity, but it was the day after. It was September 12th when George Bush announced that the result of that crime, the response to that crime by the United States, would be to take the world to war. That's what changed the world, and the choice we were given was we either go to war or we let them get away with it. And it was put forward in as brutally Manichaean a way as that. And in that context, nobody was prepared to say, let them get away with it. So people who should have known better, 88% of the American people came out in support of war in Afghanistan. By a decade later, 69 or 70% said the war in Afghanistan had never been worth fighting. Now, obviously, a lot of those 70% were in the same 88% that said it was at the beginning. They had come to understand it differently. But we face enormous challenges now that we did not face in the same way during Vietnam. As difficult as that movement was to build, and it was a hard one, it was very different. It was very different.
I want to let the listeners know we're speaking with Phyllis Bennis, the director of the New Internationalism Project. And if you'd like to join the conversation, have a question or comment in the 18 minutes or so, you can give us a call at 303-442-4242. Well, maybe, Phyllis, if you could mention, what is the New Internationalism Project and what are your objectives and programs?
What we work on at IPS is a sort of range of things involving issues of peace, justice, and the environment and the ways they're connected. My project deals with issues of U.S. support, ending U.S. support for wars and occupations in the Middle East, and for reclaiming the United Nations as part of a new internationalism that involves international law and human rights as the basis of policy rather than the use of force as the basis of policy. So it focuses a lot on U.S. policy in those regions. So looking at how do we end U.S. support for Israeli occupation. We can't have that much impact directly on Israel. Our work can be to change what happens in the U.S. with U.S. corporations through the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, through of what the U.S. government does, through opposition to U.S. military aid to Israel, etc.
And what kind of lessons would you say, as an activist, as a writer, as the director of this project, trying to work with international mechanisms and not just military force or military aid, what kind of things can you say you've learned from the Vietnam War that you bring to the work that is happening today?
I think one of the important things is the question of internationalism, that it's crucial that when we look at U.S. policies, domestic or officially global, that we recognize what the impact is of those policies on the people who are the target of them. Too often we talk about, you know, the Pentagon budget or the role of the military solely from the vantage point of what it means for people in the U.S., and we leave out what does it mean for the people of Syria, what does it mean for the Palestinians, what does it mean for wherever the U.S. is at war or threatening war or supporting governments at war. And I think that's one of the things we did learn from Vietnam was the need to identify with the victims of that war. I remember I worked with Tom for some years in the Indochina Peace Campaign, and one of the most popular pieces of literature that we distributed, I think in the hundreds of thousands, was a four-sided thing that was called 6 Million Victims, that looked at the people who had been killed and injured and made homeless in Vietnam, in Laos, and in Cambodia. And that was not something that had been traditional in anti-war movements before. This was something that was created during the Vietnam era and has among some anti-war forces more recently been done again. And I think that's very, very important. One of the other things that we've done, I think, better now, partly because we can, because of the rise in new technologies, is the notion of building global movements. We saw that in the rising movement against the war in Iraq, even before the war began. That was quite unprecedented, to have on one day, the February 15th, 2003, global protest, where people in about 250 cities across the United States and almost 700 cities around the world, in every continent, including Antarctica, people went out into the streets with the same demand. The world says no to war in 100 different languages. And that was made possible in just 6 weeks of organizing because we had the internet. You know, even if we had had the idea for something like that back in the 70s or the 60s, there was no way to do that. We used letters. You know, once in a while, long-distance phone calls, but even domestic long-distance calls were really a lot of money, and we didn't have any money. So, you sent letters to other countries to find out what was going on, or you tried to read the newspapers once in a while, but they came weeks late. Now, the fact that we can be in touch with our colleagues around the world instantly made it possible to organize that protest that brought somewhere between 14 and 16 million people into the streets on one day. It was possible to organize that in just 6 weeks. That would have been unprecedented.
Yeah, that was really amazing to be able to see when you can actually see in real time and hear what people are doing and get a visual and feel connected with what other people are doing, places where you might never ever be able to get to physically.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And how do you see this working with, specifically in the Middle East where you work with, it's there's such a strong lobby for the state of Israel and allowing Israel to get away with so many things that no other country would be able to get away with.
I mean, right. No, that's certainly true. It's a huge challenge. But the reality is that on that issue, the discourse has shifted so dramatically in the last decade, especially maybe in the last 3 or 4 years, caused partly by the fact that Israeli actions, I'm thinking particularly of the three wars in Gaza in 2008 and 9, again in 2012, and again last summer in 2014, the actions have been so brutal and so much targeting civilians, leaving thousands and thousands of Gazans without homes, almost 2,200 people killed, three-quarters of them, according to the UN, civilians, and among them large numbers of children, and the fact that that was seen around the world, the rise of social media, the fact that, you know, Israel tried during the CAF-led operation in 2008 to keep foreign journalists out of Gaza, and to some degree they succeeded, but they completely failed at the goal of keeping the news out of the rest of the world because there were already journalists in Gaza. There were Gazan journalists. And the fact that everybody in Gaza has a cell phone, and on the few hours a day when electricity might be available, the first thing people would do would be to power up their phones and get out the video and the photographs of what was actually going on. So people were seeing it at their dinner table. That was new. That had never happened with the Israeli occupation. That changed. And then you have massive change in the Jewish community, where AIPAC, you know, AIPAC is still the right wing of the Jewish community, still like the right wing of any community, has a lot of money. But it's no longer the dominant force among Jewish voters or the Jewish community as a whole. When I was growing up in the Jewish community in L.A., that's what there was. There wasn't any other option. Now you have AIPAC on the right, you have a group like J Street in the center that challenged AIPAC, that broke the taboo and said no one else can speak for Jews in Washington. Suddenly they did, and they were heard. And then on the left you have Jewish Voice for Peace, which now has something like 160,000 members and supporters, chapters in 50-some-odd cities around the country, a new advocacy office here in D.C. to work on the Hill. They're the ones who are on the rise, and I think the reason we're seeing such an intense attack by AIPAC and its friends on discussions and debates going on in the academy, in the universities, is precisely because a big part of the shift in the Jewish community is generational. They've lost the young people. The young people are flocking to JVP and some to J Street. They're not going to AIPAC, and they're freaked out about it. So that's why I think we're seeing this very intense escalation of efforts to shut down debate on things like the BDS campaign. You know, the fact, and of course it's not working. You saw this in Hillel, the biggest of the Jewish student organizations around the country. They kind of put themselves forward as the big tent representing all Jewish students. All political opinions are welcome. Except 2 years ago, they set red lines and said, we cannot accept anyone who supports BDS. No speakers
boycott,
will be allowed.
Boycott, divest, sanctions. Let's just
boycott, divestment, yeah, and sanctions. No one would be allowed to either support it, to bring a speaker to discuss it, to have a discussion about it. And students all over the country started saying, wait a minute, we have free speech rights. We have a First Amendment. Why do you get to say what what we can talk about and not? And last year, 400 of them met at Harvard University to create what's known as Open Hillel, which is the new free speech version of Hillel that can discuss anything. And that's where young Jews are moving. So they're really losing the appeal that there once was. So it's making the work that we've been doing for so many decades now much easier, and it's much more mainstream. It's no longer on the fringes. It's very much at the center of the debate.
I want to let the listeners know, if in the last 8 minutes or so, if you'd like to have a question or a comment for Phyllis Bennis, you can give us a call at 303-442-4242. Phyllis, is some of these things that have happened around the Vietnam Symposium and around the other work is available on the Internet? Where would people find out more?
Well, you know, that's a good question, and I'm afraid I don't know the answer. The the sessions at the conference were all taped. I don't know the website where it's, I don't think it's been posted yet. I can try and get that word to you, and you can put it out to your listeners. Nothing is up yet as far as I know. But I'm afraid Tom would have more information on where it's available. Sorry, I don't know that.
Oh, that's okay. Sorry. So people could go to maybe the stay at the Institute for Policy Studies.
Absolutely. Yeah, our website is ips-dc.org, and they can go to my project, many of our other projects. Lots of interesting stuff there.
And so your project is through the IPS website.
That's right.
And I understand you're working on a book. What is your next project going to be?
I am. It's going to be out within about a month. It's called Understanding ISIS and the New Global War on Terror. And it tries to provide sort of a basic overview of who these forces are, ISIS and the associated terrorist forces, violent forces who are fighting, what the U.S. is doing in response, why it's not working, and some ideas about the history and the origins of these movements and what U.S. policy is about, and ideas about what we should be proposing as alternatives to the current failing military strategy as a way of dealing with ISIS.
Well, maybe in about the last 7 minutes or so, we could talk briefly about that, since that's the current war. We started out talking about Vietnam.
I know it's a difficult one because in some ways it's not really a new war, even though I use that term in the title. It's a very much a continuation of George Bush's war, what he called the Global War on Terror. You might call it Global War on Terror 2.0. President Obama was elected to end the war in Iraq. He did promise to escalate in Afghanistan. He did both of those things. The ending of the Iraq War was very brief. It was also quite grudging, although President Bush had actually signed the agreement with the Iraqi government promising to pull out all troops and all mercenaries being paid by the Pentagon. The Obama administration actually tried very hard to convince the Iraqi government to allow U.S. troops to remain indefinitely. But they couldn't get them to agree to give U.S. troops impunity for any war crimes they might commit. And without that kind of an agreement, without that kind of a promise, the U.S. went ahead and implemented the agreement Bush had signed and pulled out all the troops. As we know, that was in the end of 2011. By 2014, U.S. troops were headed back into Iraq, and there are now several thousand U.S. troops back in Iraq, and U.S. bombers attacking Syria and backing the Saudi campaign against Yemen. Drone attacks are on the rise in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Somalia, and elsewhere that we probably don't even know about. So this is definitely an escalating war that we are seeing. And unfortunately, it's going on without much congressional oversight or control. There was, for a while, some debate about the so-called authorizations for the use of military force. Obama said that he was relying on the 2001 authorization, one that he said as a senator and as a candidate should be eliminated because it's so out of date. But now he says that gives him the right to send troops anywhere in the world, essentially, without any other oversight. And the Congress has simply given up on any effort to create real accountability for those troops. So we see a continuation of this war without the use of large numbers of ground troops. That part is true. But those ground troops have not simply been withdrawn. They've been replaced by smaller teams of special forces and huge numbers of drones and bombers. So we're sending bombs and drone rockets rather than U.S. troops, which means, among other things, that the victims of the war, those who are killed in the war, do not include American troops. From the vantage point of gaining public support, that's very useful. If there's no Americans dying, people tend not to pay much attention. The blood of Afghans and Iraqis and Syrians and so many others, Pakistanis, Somalis, Yemenis, their blood doesn't have the impact on the American people that American blood does. And we have to acknowledge that. That's one of the challenges facing today's anti-war movement. And it's one of the reasons that I think we need a very different kind of movement. And that is that rather than trying to create a separate independent peace movement that identifies itself that way, as made up of the same people who were at the center of the movement during Vietnam and during Central America and even during the Iraq period, meaning overwhelmingly, not entirely, of course, but overwhelmingly white, middle-class, older people who were at the core of those recent movements. We need a movement who sees its role being to provide to the movements that are in motion right now, the Black Lives Matter movements, the immigrant rights movements, the movements for environmental justice, to be providing to all of those movements the kind of information about the cost of war, the cost of the Pentagon budget and what it does to our communities, the militarization of our communities, what happens when soldiers come back from fighting in Iraq and the police, the national police organizations are working to encourage police departments to hire former soldiers regardless of whether or not they might have PTSD. I mean, there's some shocking information out there about that question. So all of these are, I think, the new obligations of a new kind of peace movement that we need for the coming period. It's going to be a huge challenge, but the good news is that there are new movements that are in motion right now, and I think our job is to make sure that they have all of the information they can possibly use to do that mobilization in those communities that are the most effective, the most affected by the diversion of funds to the Pentagon, that are the victims among the soldiers who can't get decent medical care, all of that. These are the communities that are in motion, and our job is to bring the anti-war information to them.
Thank you. I think we have time for a very quick question. Dan, time for a very quick question or comment.
Yeah. Ago. My question goes... Yeah, that was a long time ago. My question goes to back to Israel-Palestine. One of the ideas of war and stopping wars, one of the theories is if one side has an overwhelming superiority, majority, you know, like the other side has nothing, there is no incentive whatsoever for the ruling, the winning side, to negotiate. That's right. Exactly what it is between Gaza and Israel. How do we get by that?
Well, I think what we do is recognize that the solution is not going to come from negotiations between Israel and Palestine in the current environment for exactly the reasons you say. It's the same reason that we learned from Martin Luther King, the notion that you always negotiate eventually, but you don't always negotiate when you're weak. So you work to change the balance of forces, and then you negotiate. So in the context of Palestine, what that means is that Palestinian civil society is really in the lead these days in terms of creating a national strategy for Palestinian rights. And it's based on the idea that we need a global movement who can bring outside pressure, nonviolent economic pressure, mainly through the BDS movement. In the U.S., it's BDS plus all the work on challenging U.S. military aid and U.S. support in the U.N. But the goal is to bring outside pressure to bear on Israel so that it can no longer continue to have the kind of impunity that allows it to violate international law so consistently without ever being held accountable. Once that begins to change, and once that starts to have an impact on Israelis, if FIFA, for instance, accepts the Palestinian demand that Israel not be allowed to play in the next World Cup, that's going to have a real impact on the Israeli Jewish population who cares about soccer. Those kinds of campaigns are what's going to have to happen. Then there can be negotiations.
And thank you so much. Thank you, Dan. And thank you, Phyllis. I'm so sorry we've run out of time, and we'll just have to get you back on after your new book is out. So thank you so much.